I'm Paddy Hanlon, production sound mixer with the CAS, and today I'm in conversation with production sound mixer Willie D. Burton.
Don't ever let somebody tell you you can't do something. Not even me. All right?
All right.
You got a dream, you got to protect it. People can't do something themselves. They want to tell you you can't do it. You want something, go get it. Period.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
I see you, Frank. I see you standing over the grave of another dead president.
It's not easy for me to admit that I've been standing in the same place for 18 years.
Well, I've been standing with you. I've been right here with you, Troy. I got a life, too. I gave 18 years of my life to stand in the same spot as you.
Half the German army's on our tail, and you want me to go to Berlin? Into the lion's den?
Yes. The only thing that matters is the grail.
How about a nice game of chess?
If you've gone to the movies any time from the 70s up to now, you've seen Willie D. Burton's work many times. Winner of the CAS Award this year for Oppenheimer, along with BAFTA and Oscar nominations. Willie has had one of the longest careers in the business.
Are we okay to kick off then?
Absolutely.
Willie Burton, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today. And congratulations on Oppenheimer, the CAS Award this year. Pleasure to speak to you.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
When I went to dig into it, to do research, I was like, whoa, like this is a huge career.
I've done a couple of shows, yeah.
A couple of shows, and you're still going.
Still going, man.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
No, I appreciate that. Thanks so much. It's been an amazing career for me. I'm very fortunate, you know. I'm thankful and grateful for my career that I've had, and I couldn't ask for a better career.
No, I'm straight up jealous, I have to say.
Well, you know, I'm older than you, so you got some time.
You won Oppenheimer's CAS this year, but you also won for Dreamgirls in 2007. And then you had nominations from the CAS for In the Line of Fire in 94 and one of the Spider-Man movies in 2022. And then you had a Career Achievement Award in 2005.
I should have been retired then, right? After I got my Career Achievement Award. Isn't that what that's for?
Well, I think from the movies that you did, I think they should have given it to you way earlier.
Right.
Well, you had an Oscar win with Dreamgirls and Bird, directed by Clint Eastwood. And then you had many nominations. First of all, for Buddy Holly, the Buddy Holly story.
The Buddy Holly story was my first one. It's
complicated, especially, I think, for back then as well.
Yeah, it was all live. As a matter of fact, we started out doing like playback.
Yeah.
And Steve Rash, our director, he said, you know, we really can't do playback. We got to do this live. And we did everything live. And that wasn't easy to do in those days, but we did it, and it was, you know, it was incredible.
Hey, I'm not buying bebop.
Well, I did tell him no more bebop music.
Well, then go after him. Cut him off the air. Do something.
Well, no, sir, I can't cut him off, but I'm going to call out there and tell Parker to tell him to quit that stuff.
I tell you what, you got about 30 seconds to get that off the air. I'm going to pull every damn one of my spots. You understand me?
Don't sound half bad, though.
It's very visible, Gary Busey and the two guys.
Right.
Once they're on it, you can tell that they're in full performance. And every performance.
Oh, they were hot. They were ready. They were ready for it. You know, they rehearsed and rehearsed. And you know, they felt the music. They felt that, you know, that Gary Busey felt. He said, you know, like, I'm Buddy Holly, you know.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
He lived in his skin, all right. When you were a kid, like when you were 12, 13, did you always want to be a sound man? Like, is this a path that you had mapped out in front of you? Or is it something that you fell into, so to speak?
Well, I think that in a way, I fell into it, not in the industry, but the idea of being in audio.
Right.
As a young adult, I grew up in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, one of the hottest radio stations, WTUG. You know, going to church every so often, I would pass this radio station, and yeah. The music was always so cool and so R&B and just make you feel like you want to dance. So, you know, and I thought, well, let me just take a peek inside.
Yeah.
So I peeked inside one day and I could see the DJ spinning the records and moving the control knobs.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, I know I can't be a DJ, but maybe I can be someone who controls those knobs. I can be in audio and yeah. this would be a great career for me. During my high school career, the school offered a program called Diversified Occupation, and I was able to study radio and television in high school. And I was also able to work in the community, like in a radio and TV shop, a couple hours every day, 5 days a week, and I would get class credit. So when I was like 15 years old, I could repair radios and television. Believe it or not. I mean, it was pretty amazing. I thought, God, and people would joke. They said, there come the TV boy, they called me. And I was only like 15 years old, but I had my little caddy and tubes, you know, it was tubes in those days. And I could carry the caddy around and I made house calls. And people were amazed because I was only like 15 years old.
So you were like completely on the electronics route. You went straight in deeper.
I was on the electronic route.
Yeah.
And, but I still eventually wanted to get into audio. So graduated from high school. I moved to Long Beach, California to study higher education in electronics. Because
right.
I didn't know much about trying to get in audio at that time. So I thought, okay, the best thing for me is to study electronics.
Yeah.
So I attended West Coast Trade School in Linwood, California. And later I enrolled in Compton Junior College, and I studied audio and engineering there. They had a program that audio/engineering, got involved in that. And then later I transferred to Long Beach City College, where they had an electronic technology engineering program. In the meantime, I was working part-time, you know, busboy, dishwasher, detail cars, whatever I had to do to survive.
Yeah.
Because I was on my own, you know, I came to California when I was like 17 years old.
Paying the rent. You do their jobs to pay the rent, essentially.
To pay the rent. And I had a roommate and everything. I was just trying to pay the rent and also go to school. I wanted to go to school.
Yeah.
And my friends would say to me that, you know, well, you should just get a job in the construction industry that pays a lot of money. And you know, because you're never going to get a job in electronics. And I thought, no, I need to do this. This is what I need to do. And believe it or not, after so much time in school, I thought, maybe I don't want to be an electronic engineer. So I started applying for jobs. And
yeah.
I finally got a job with the Long Beach Naval Shipyard. They were hiring. So I filled out this application and everything. And I was hired in the sonar division, engineering division at Long Beach Naval Shipyard. And so amazing. I mean, I don't have a 4-year degree, but technically I was pretty good with stuff and had pretty decent background and all of that. So I worked in the sonar field.
You were already after training yourself to a good degree.
Well, they brought me in because of my experience that I had. You know, they knew I had some experience and they thought this might be a good fit for me. At a very young age, I was traveling abroad to the Philippines, to Japan, to assist the Navy personnel on the ship to repair their sonar system. If the sonar system went down, no matter where the ship was, my division would send me there along with the representative from the factory. We would go and get the sonar system working, get it up again where they could go out to sea.
How old were you when you were doing this?
About somewhere around maybe about 20, 21 years old.
That's insane.
It was pretty amazing. I was so young. I never thought about it. I was just hustling, trying to make it because my parents never had much. And I didn't want to rely on them.
Yeah.
So the thing for me is that being an independent kid, I said, I have to make it on my own. I never asked my mom and dad for a dime when I left home. I said, I've got to do this on my own. Yeah. And so I would just, you know, all about my career. This is what I have to do. But in the meantime, I got married. I got married at a very young age. I got married when I was 20 years old. And my first daughter was born when I was 20 years old. Wow. So, I mean, you know, now I got, not only do I need to hustle and take care of myself, I need to take care of family now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They promoted me. I got promoted like once a year. I was always promoted.
Excellent.
And after about 3 years or so of that, maybe three and a half years, I thought, okay, I have a great job. It's a white collar job. I mean, I was, you know, my job was to work in an office to do the paperwork. When I would go aboard ship, shipboard, I was considered as an officer.
Yeah.
So they treated me as an officer. So when I had to stay overnight on a ship, I would sleep in the officer quarters and eat with the officer. So it was a great job. I have no question about it. It was a great job.
Did you have to do any kind of military training or anything, or you?
No,
were just...
no. I just the government, my department, just sent me to sonar school classes.
Right.
You know, 2 months here, 3 months there, specializing in different sonar systems. So having this job, I'm thinking, okay, this is a great job, great career. You know, I wear a tie every day to work, and my peers, you know, they would say to me, Willie, this is good for you because now you have a family. You can 25 years, 35 years, you can retire. You're very young, and this would be wonderful for you. So after about 3.5 years, I got the audio bug again.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, here's this career going for me.
And everybody's looking at you going, Willie, what are you doing?
And it's like, okay, I got the audio bug. And I thought that I really wanted to do audio. I didn't want to be an engineer.
Yeah.
You know, I wanted to work in audio, and that was my dream. So I said to myself, what do I do? So I started to make phone calls to the union. Local 695 in Hollywood. And so one day someone answered the phone and I said, you know, I would like to get into the union to work in audio because I found out that you need to be in the union.
Yeah.
Of course, that person, whoever it was, said to me, well, you need a job first. A job? Where do I get the job? Well, the studios are the one that's hiring. So eventually I was able to get into the sound department at one of the studios. And that person said to me, no, you need to be in the union before we can hire you. So now it's catch 22.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought, okay, I've got to figure this out. You know, I know I need to be in the union. One thing happened to me in my life, which was pretty amazing, is that a newly business agent was elected. And that was Jack Coffey. I mean, bless his heart today. He's passed, but he was elected. And I finally called one day and he answered the phone. And I told him what I wanted. And he said, come and see me. So I had an interview with him. And he was a business agent he got elected as a business agent for the local.
Yeah.
And he said to me that, Willie, I want to help you get in. You know, let me look at your resume and all of that. Send me a resume. I sent him a resume. He says, oh, I like your resume. One day he called me and says, the board wants to meet you. They like your resume. They really wants to meet you. Now, they didn't know what color I was. You know,
right.
I'm just a guy with a resume that looks pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
So after work, I drove up to the meet. They had a meeting at night, 7 o'clock at night, usually the board meetings. And I drove to Studio City and I sat at the head of the conference table. And the majority of them would say, you know, that we don't advise this for you because with your family, you know, you're going to be getting into a business that's not stable.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to deal with that. Well, the thing about it, I mean, I've always been a hustler, even while working for the Department of the Navy. I was a custodian. I had a custodian job at a bank in Long Beach. I would clean that bank at night, five nights a week. Only took me an hour and a half to clean the bank.
Right.
So I kept that job as a safety. I got paid, you know, once a month. They paid me a nice fee for cleaning the bank. And I kept that job. So I thought, okay, this is my ace in the hole. So I never got rid of that job.
Perfect.
And walking outside of the local, outside the door, the office, I, you know, something said to me, maybe they're right. Maybe this is not right for me. Maybe this is not the thing that I want to do. but at the time, I was driving an old car. I'm just hustling, trying to make ends meet. I have an old car, nothing fancy, just good transportation vehicle. I walk outside the office. I head to the parking lot looking for my car. I'm looking around. I see all these nice cars. I mean, really, I mean, beautiful cars. You know, I mean, trucks, nice, expensive trucks. I mean, you know, I saw a couple of Porsches and Mercedes, and I thought, well, they're doing okay.
It's a good way to try and judge an industry. It's nearly like judging someone after shoes.
I you know, you're right. I mean, you know, and I said, wow, okay, they've done okay. Yeah. I can't drive a car like this. Even with my government job, I can't drive a car like this. So this little voice inside my head said to me that you want to be in audio. You want to try to continue to get into the union. And I did. One day I received a call from the union office. And the person at the office said to me that we have a one-day call for you at 20th Century Fox.
Right.
I took a leave from my job for that day and worked on the job. Skippy was the secretary at the sound department at 20th Century Fox. And she said to me, you know, Willie, this is a one-day call, but I'm going to try to keep you on as much as I can. And so I called my job at the Department of the Navy and said, you know, I need to take a month off. You know, I don't know what I said, but I wasn't honest, but I just know I didn't want to lose that job and gain another, you know, a job that wasn't too, that I couldn't get in the union. And so believe it or not, I was able to get my 30 days in. And once I got my 30 days in, I called my job, you know, at the government, and I says, I'm quitting.
Right.
They said, what? We just sent you to school. You quitting? I said, yeah, I need to change careers. I'm so sorry. You know, I need to make a change. And I quit the government job. And I stayed on for a while at 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
And then I was able to work inside in post-production to learn how to load mags and learn about post-production and all of that, the mixing and all of that. So that was a good experience for me. And then I finally got laid off. It was devastating. I've never been laid off in my life. So I get laid off.
Yeah.
But I still had the job at the bank, though. I still was a custodian at night, cleaning the job at the, you know, cleaning up the bank.
This was like your first taste of going into freelance, essentially.
Right, right. Yeah, it was a backup plan for me because the job was so good cleaning the bank, and they paid me a fair amount of money that I couldn't give it up. I didn't want to give it up. So that's why I kept that job.
Yeah.
But I was out of work for a while. And then when the season started up again, like maybe 3 months later, I've got a call from MGM Studios, the sound department head over there, Frank Milton. And he hired me and I started working as a sound cable person on Medical Center, a TV show called Medical Center.
Oh, really?
And I worked on that show and I learned, I would practice with the boom because I wanted to learn how to boom and all of that. So. Mm. About a year went by, I guess a year of working on the show, and the boom person didn't show up. He was ill. So I said, Willie, it's on you. You've got a boom. So I said, okay. But I had, you know, practice, and I was pretty good, actually. That's when I really started booming, because that was sort of like just a sound utility.
Do you mind me asking, was this on a fish pole or was this a Fisher boom?
No, Fisher boom. In those days, it's all Fisher booms.
We
only used fish pole, boom pole for maybe a second mic, if we use a second mic. In those days, mixers didn't like to use too many microphones. That was always the challenge for that time period. But anyway, funny thing about it, I was booming, and Chad Everett, the star, you know, he was messing around, and he raised up real fast, and I hit him in the head with the microphone. So people are like, oh my God, you just hit him in the head with the microphone, and you know, and I'm like, oh my God, what did I do? I mean, I thought, well, are they gonna fire me? But the thing about it, he was kidding around.
Oh really? Was this day one?
It was a joke on me. Because he knew I was new at Boomin, he tried to trick me.
Fair play to him.
Because he tried to trick me to see could I get out of his way fast enough, but he hit the boom before I could get out of his way.
Right.
But anyway, so from that point, then Frank Milton, the head of the sound department, he came down to the set one day and he says, I hear you've been booming some. Do you want to go booming? Absolutely, I want to go booming.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a seniority system, group one, group two, group three. And then if you change your classification to a boom person, then it's like, my peers was telling me, well, you're stuck. I mean, you know, that's a position you're going to be in for a while and you don't have a show. So what are you going to do? I says, I'm going to go booming. And I was advised not to go booming, not to change my classification. But because working for the government, it was all about promoting you and learning new things and new ideas. And that was my background. Mm-hmm. I wasn't familiar with no seniority system that it takes so many years to do this, so many years to do that. That wasn't my background. So I thought, well, let me use the government example on how to get ahead. And so I was booming and everything for a while. Then the boom person came back. Then I was like sound utility /boom on the show.
Yeah.
And then eventually I said, you know, I'm going freelancing. I left the show, went freelancing as a boom person. But a sound mixer I knew, he wanted me to work on a show that he was going to do. So I said, okay, I'm with you.
So you were leaving the studio structure, essentially.
I left the studio structure, even though I went to another studio on a show to boom the show. But I left the studio that I was at. And not only that, at that time, the independent field was beginning to start a little bit. You know, there was independent projects like miniseries and that type of things and pilots and all of that they were doing. So I figured, okay, I'll take my chances. One day I wake up and, you know, I listen to this little voice inside my head from time to time. Sometimes it's right.
Sometimes they're wrong.
And other times it gets me in trouble.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But this little voice, you know, it says to me that you want to be a mixer. You don't want to boom. You don't need to boom anymore. You want to be a mixer. So now I 4 years in the industry and I'm talking about being a mixer. And I was told that because of seniority system, the best way to become a mixer was wait until you were promoted through a studio. So I was working on a show on the Burbank studio lot and the mixer was leaving. So I asked the producer, could I be the mixer on the show if I changed my classification? And then the sound department had, the producer said, as long as it's okay with the sound department. Mm-hmm. But the sound department had said no.
So then the seniority kind of system back then was strong. That was the way it was done. It was like the law, correct?
It was very strong, yeah. Matter of fact, majority of the people going from, say, sound utility to mixing, you're talking about years. You're talking 10, 12, 15 years, if it happens then.
Yeah.
I contact the union, and I said, I want to go mixing. They said, you want to go mixing? Well, if you go mixing, you have to pass this test. And once you pass a test, if you become a mixer, you change your classification, you can't go back to booming for a year. So you're going to be stuck as a mixer. Now you're not going, if you don't have a job, you're not going to be able to work. And they say, you don't have a job. So what are you going to do?
Why did they do that? Was it to put you off or was it?
No,
like,
it was just a system.
Yeah.
It was just the system, it's just an old system that was in place. And reason they discourage you because they were right. Once you change your classification and you didn't have a job, then, you know, you're SOL. What are you going to do? If you have a family to take care of and you have responsibilities, you know, bills to pay, your mortgage or your rent, there was no HBO, no Showtime. There was none of that. It was just all major studios. And there was sound department. Every studio had a sound department. And sound department, you know, gave you your jobs. They call you in and says, I have a job for you, you know. And so that's how you got your jobs. So that person basically controlled your career to some degree. I passed the test, changed my classification. And once I did that, I said, oh, my God, what have I done? I don't have a job. But I was still at the bank. I never gave up my custodian job. All this time, I still had my custodian job.
Yeah, man. Yeah, the card in the back pocket.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So that was working for me. So then I kept juggling my resume. I kept changing things in my resume. I put things in my resume that I've heard of that I never worked on. But it's like I've got to get a job. I was desperate. So I need to get a job. I mean, what am I going to do? I mean, you know, time went by. Time was going by because I said, I've changed my classification. Now I don't have a mixing job. But in the meantime, friends of mine was always doing like little projects, like little short films because they wanted to be directors or producers or writers. They would do their own little films. So I bought my own equipment. And I would go work with them on the weekends, mixing, you know, making sure I, you know, had it all down, making sure I knew what to do, which I did anyway. I was able to you know, enhance my skills by doing that because they didn't pay me any money. So if I made a mistake, it was no big deal, you know.
That's the secret of the shorts, isn't it? Especially when you're starting off, it's like, well, you're not giving me anything. So, you know, not that it's neglectful.
Right. I mean, you want to do a great job, but you know what I mean? There's always mistakes can happen when you're doing sound. I mean, you know, or like the radio mics wasn't that good in those days. So there's breakup, there's interference, there's all kinds of stuff that you run into. But I learned. I practiced, I learned. Anytime I was offered a job that didn't pay, I took the job. And I learned. I learned. I wanted to learn everything I possibly could. I also wanted to learn more about the equipment that we had, which was pretty much a Niagara recorder in those days. But once again, this little voice, it talks to you from time to time, you know? So I wake up one morning and this little voice said to me, you started at 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
Skippy, who was the secretary there, hired you and call her up and see if you can observe. You can go in and observe like ADR and Foley, learn how to do ADR and Foley.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I call her up one day and she says, come on in. Perfect. We're happy to have you. So I went to the ADR stage and Foley stage. And this engineer there, he showed me how to operate the equipment, showed me everything, how to do it. I spent 2 days there learning how to do ADR and Foley. Yeah. One day I get a call from Skippy. And she said to me, did you learn anything when you were here in ADR and Foley? I said, yes. She says, I have a call for you tomorrow. My first mixing job ever.
Perfect.
So now I was doing Foley at ADR like 2-3 days a week.
Excellent.
And so I'm liking this. I'm loving this. And then I had, you know, in the past, I've been working at the Warner Brothers studio as a boom person doing commercials and different things. And once the sound department found out that I was a mixer, now they called me to do commercials.
Money, more money.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now I have no time to do ADR and Foley anymore.
You're mixing these commercials?
Mixing. They did a lot of commercials in those days. So I would work on commercials. And then one day I received a call from the sound department and he asked me, was Hal Landecker. I have a TV show. Would you like to work on a TV show? Absolutely. So I went from commercial to a TV show called Police Story.
Really?
Yeah. Now I'm on, you know, and he wouldn't tell me what it was. He told me what to show up and everything. And that Friday, he didn't tell me what it was. And I received a call sheet and it said Police Story.
Wow.
That was a hot show. Now, I'm a mixer on a hot TV show.
That's amazing.
You know, it's always some luck. You got to have luck along the way. And you have to have people in your corner, you know, willing to help you from time to time. But sometimes you have to make the first step for them to assist you.
Would the studio have provided you with gear or could you use your own gear on that show?
No, during that time, the studio provided gear for you. Even though I owned some of my own equipment, but you have to use the studio equipment. That was a deal that majority of the studios around town in Los Angeles. But anyway, I got called for other jobs, you know, some commercials here, some commercials there. And I finally got, you know, pilots, couple pilots here and there. And Sidney Poitier Company was doing a film.
Yeah.
And that film was Let's Do It Again.
In the innermost reaches of your heart, you are a tiger.
Tiger!
You are capable of great feats of strength and courage.
Strength and courage!
You can beat any fighter in the world. You will win the championship.
I will?
Yes. Out of sight.
So I thought, you know, let me call and see, can I get in for an interview?
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, I'm not going to get in for an interview because I don't have a lot of experience. I just have some TV experience, you know, one show and pilots and but at least it's worth a chance, you know?
All they can say is no.
All they can say is no. Well, I was able to go in for the interview. Now, the production manager and the producer, you know, asked me a lot of questions about my background, what I've been doing and everything. I told them. And they had had some bad experience on one of Sidney's other shows that they had to fire the person because he wasn't doing a good job. Yeah. So now here I am. I'm coming along with not a lot of experience.
And they're paranoid.
And they're paranoid, you know, and I can understand. I totally could understand because I didn't think I was going to get the job anyway.
Yeah.
So they suggested that, well, maybe the next show, the next film they do, I might have more experience. It might be better for me.
Right.
And Sidney was sitting there. He just listened. He didn't say too much. He just listened and, you know, looking at them, looking at me. And I said, well, you know, I really appreciate it. I mean, and thank you for the opportunity. Thank you for the for letting me interview. And Sidney stood up. And he looked at me and he said to me, he says, I'm going to give you a chance. He said, but you better not screw it up. He said, I'm going to give you this job and you better not screw it up. You better not let me down.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got the job.
It's like the best experience and the most nerve-wracking experience all wrapped in one.
Absolutely. They were so happy with the sound. And Sidney and I became best friends until he passed.
That's brilliant.
Every time I was available, when he did a film after that, he calls me.
That's amazing.
So it's so amazing. I mean, but this is how life works sometimes, you know. You just to get in for an interview and just to try and meet people, and next thing you know, your life is changing. Sidney changed my life.
Yeah.
Because from that point on, I decided I'm going to do mostly films.
That's amazing. And I suppose at your age back then, he was a hero. He was a lot of people's hero.
Oh, he was a hero. He was everybody's hero then. Yeah, I've always looked up to him even before I worked with him. He's always been like one of my idols.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because I thought he was so amazing and so talented. And once you learn about his story, where he came from and where he ended up was pretty amazing as well. Pretty incredible.
He broke a lot of ground, and he did it with such style as well.
He did, right, absolutely. And
he
class,
was cool.
Style, class. So he had a lot of class.
Yeah. A lot of class, yeah, yeah, right. He was cool.
And my career just took off. It just took off from there. And I pretty much tried to stay with films, and that's what I've done majority of my career.
It took off in like a house on fire kind of way, didn't it? Like it's an amazing journey that you've been on.
Well, it was an amazing journey, but you know what was good during that time period is that most of the jobs came out of Hollywood.
Right.
So you would get an opportunity, a more offers, like multiple offers to do a film. And then you as an individual, me, you have to decide which film you want to do. And so I tried to pick what I thought for me was a better quality film, even though if I had to wait longer, even though sometimes they always say that, you know, that if you get off a film and it's a sure thing, take it. Don't wait for anything else because it's a maybe. But I was one of these people that, you know, that I would wait. I would say, oh, this film is okay, but I have a potential to get another film if I wait that I think will be a better quality film, higher quality and more prestige. And I would do that. That's how I sort of like did my career.
In relation to you wanting to do films, was it like, for me, it's like I'm more attracted to the creative. I'm more attracted to the creative team, the film atmosphere as we're shooting it. Is that what you were more interested in? Or like what was the difference that you seen between film and TV shows at that time?
Well, one thing I learned that working on a film is that you have an opportunity to do a better job.
Yes.
You have an opportunity to do quality work.
Yes.
And not that you can't do quality work on a television show, but you know, to some degree, there's not enough time because in television, you have to shoot so many pages a day.
Yeah.
And you have to get the work done, which I understand. I totally understand that.
Yeah.
So there's times that, you know, you just need one more take. And the AD will say that we're losing the light. So we're losing the light. We can't do one more take. You know, this is it. We got to go with it. That's it. So, you know, you just don't get the opportunities. Now, more and more today, a lot of the streaming shows, they're shooting like many features. So you have a little bit more time. But once again, I mean, when you're shooting, when you're filming like 8-10 pages a day, you know, you've got to get the work done. So working on films, majority of the time, you would get an opportunity to do another take.
Yeah.
If something's not right, you know what I mean? You tell the director, he'll say, okay, let's do another take then. Let's make it right for sound.
Yeah, you have a decision to make with the director. You can get involved in the creative process a little bit more than a TV show. A TV show is more, let's get it done, let's get it done. Where a director for a feature will select you specifically in most cases.
Well, they do. See, now, like, well, even then, they would director would hire you based on your reputation and everything. And so even, you know, director would say, OK, we have Willie Burton or we have whoever. And I know the sound is going to be OK. And so they're on your side to start with. And so it becomes more or less a friendship, you know, a relationship.
Exactly.
And now it's easy for you to go talk to the director and say, look, I just have to have another one. Well, I messed up here. I lost my plant mic. The battery went dead in it or whatever, you know, and I really need another one. And they would give you another one. Now, television would say, no, we got to move on. I mean, not all the time, but sometimes they do that. So, yeah. In the earlier days, I mean, you know, we were so meticulous about doing clean sound.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like the earlier days was all about perfect and clean sound, and you work hard to do that.
Yeah.
But as time has passed, I mean, I think we all as mixers, we learn to accept certain background noises.
Absolutely.
Whether it's traffic, whatever, as long as it's part of the visuals.
Absolutely.
You know, if you see a freeway, well, you can hear a little freeway, you know, I mean, not overpowering, but you can hear freeway or whatever is going on. And that's what I always say. You can live with it a little bit better than in the past. And plus the fact the equipment in post-production is so high tech now, which enhances so much and it gives us more of an opportunity for better sound. Even if the sound on production is just sort of okay, the best you can do, they can enhance it and make it so much better. And that's what's good today compared to the earlier days.
But the earlier days, you had a little bit more cooperation, I suppose. It was a little, do you think it was a little bit easier? Did people kind of, you know, sympathize with you a little bit more? Where nowadays they're a little bit more dismissive because the knowledge is there. Oh, they'll fix that later. You know what I mean? And as well, I found over the last few years where I'd always record sounds that were problems to give them to them as a noise print or even to be able to add it in, you know, like technical things that you're...
Absolutely.
Where now it's like, okay, you're making that decision of like, oh, they'll just remove that. Like it's changed even in the last few years that...
Right, absolutely.
The way we're thinking about the noise on set, you know?
Right, right. Well, you know, in the earlier days that directors would work with you, there's many times in earlier days that because the radio mics was really no good.
Yeah.
And the director would shoot a master shot, wide master shot. And he would say to you, I don't care about the sound. Don't worry about the sound.
Which makes logical, perfect logical
right,
sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Today, if you don't get the sound on the master shot, it's like, oh my God. But, yeah. But once again, we're using 2 and 3 cameras too.
Exactly.
So we got some close-up cameras. We have, you know, medium shots. We have wide shots.
Yeah. Script supervisor wants to know what they're saying, if they're ad-libbing and stuff.
It's right, like... right, right. And directors will work with sound in earlier days to do close-ups for you.
Yeah.
Or that person would say to you, sure, you know, let's... I'm going to cover this for you. I'm going to do this and sound will be okay.
Yeah.
Now, close-ups and masters, they're all in the same shots now. I think even today that DPs are under such stressful situation to get the work done that, you know, they almost have to shoot two cameras, at least two cameras. Three, yeah. You don't have to, but sometimes they do, 2 and 3 cameras, because they're trying to get the work done for the day. So they really have very little time to deal with sound. I mean, there's a few that will, I'll try to help you as much as I can. And when they see it's a real, if it's a real problem, serious problem, and sometimes the DP will say, go to the director and say, can we just not use this camera for this? Let sound get in and get the shot.
Yeah.
Because there's times that when you're filming, you get a printed, when you're filming, you get a printed take. And now they change one camera, but the other camera stays wide all the time, never changes. So now you said, okay, they're getting all these tight shots. What am I going to do? So that's when a DP sometimes will say, can we we have it on a wide shot already. Can we just drop the wide shot and let sound get in?
Yeah, or else get what you need in the wide and then let them break the frame, you know?
Right, absolutely, just absolutely.
Be practical about it, yeah.
Take, go.
This is Kimberly Wells. I'm speaking to you from the inside of the control room of the Ventana Nuclear Power Plant. With me is Mr. Jack Goodell, who has taken control of this plant by force and has demanded to make a statement. Mr. Goodell?
I'm a shift supervisor here. I have been here since before it ever opened. I want you to know one thing. I don't want to hurt anybody. I'm not going to try to contaminate the state of California. I just want you to... Monday last, at 3:36 p.m., we had an event happen. We had an accident.
The China Syndrome.
Jane Fonda, Jack Lemmon, and Michael Douglas playing a documentary filmmaker. I think he did it. He played it well, I think.
He did. Wow. What an incredible film. I mean, Michael Douglas was so incredible. Jack Lemmon, they all were.
Yeah.
Jane Fonda. I mean, it was the best team to work with. Not only that, it was a challenging film, but also just, it was like family. It's like working with a family. And one of my best experiences.
How did you get on with Jack Lemmon? Like at that point as well, he was at a peak.
Jack Lemmon was wonderful. Wonderful man, you know, cooperative, put radio mics on him. No one ever said, you know, don't do this, don't do that, don't touch me. You know, it just made our job so much easier working with them. And even Jane Fonda. I mean, she was a delight to work with. And like I said, a great experience. And it turned out to be a great film, too.
Yeah, it was a great film. I think there was a lot of awareness. It was like that kind of time, wasn't it, about nuclear?
The time period, right, sure.
Was that a set or was that a location?
A location. All those motors and all of that. Some was set, but all those big motors and stuff was a location. And it wasn't easy. I mean, we're trying to, record sound and get the sound and all these motors and stuff running. And we tried to get, you know, some of them turned off. We could, but there was others we couldn't. So we had to work with it, but it worked. It actually worked for sound.
And that big control room, was that an actual control room in a location? Like that was a huge room for you to deal with. Like it's always daunting when you go into a space that big and that reflective, essentially.
Yeah, they built a control room,
They built it. That's a huge set build.
That was it. Yeah, it was a big build. It was a big set. Yeah.
David, if he's still alive, why did the obituary say he's dead?
No, he's not dead. He left. When they know too much, they give him new identities. Anyway, the computer said so.
Oh, the computer said so. Is that the computer that's still playing the games? It's the military's computer. Why wouldn't they know about it?
They don't know about Joshua. Balkan knows about Joshua. He's the only one who knows what it can do. That computer is trying to win the game that we asked it to play. For real. You don't even believe me.
David.
It's not dead.
I'm sorry. I believe you.
War games.
War games. Oh, yeah.
As a kid that was born in the mid-70s, grew up in the 80s. And this is going to show throughout this interview, like, a lot of your movies is like my youth.
That shows you I'm old. But, yeah, War Games, you know, that was such a big deal. I remember that set, which was built at MGM Studios.
The control room again?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It took months to get that set right, to get things working and everything. And I remember there was one director original on it, and John Badham took over. Unfortunately, that he left and John Badham took over. And I had, you know, worked with John Badham before, and he hired me. So it was just great to work on that, on that film.
It was such an impressive looking set. Towards the end of that movie, like, it really sucked you into the whole panic and the,
absolutely, right.
But that scene as well, the ferry, was that a hard one to put together, or was it like, right, just let's record it?
No, I mean, it wasn't hard. I mean, you're right. It's pretty much record it, yeah.
Really, really. And it works perfectly. I was just wondering, I was like, right, okay. Did he record the engine separately? Did you have to, like, did you even ask?
Well, we always do. One thing that I always do wild tracks and stuff, you know, effects. I do that. Yeah. But unfortunately for that scene that we were moving, so we had to have the engine on. But yeah, but later on, I mean, you know, we did wild tracks and, well, you know, just to make sure that we had something. So because it depends on how they're turned to the sound, you know, like with their mics on.
Yeah.
You turn away, it's less sound. You turn towards the sound, then you get more. So then we do the wild background tracks and stuff just to filter it out. So
that's the thing. Like, when I look at it, it looks like it's working. And that's what kind of dragged you into it.
Oh, yeah. No, it was working. Yes. Great experience for me. I mean, you know, great experience working on it.
And you won a BAFTA.
A BAFTA.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know I was really nominated. You know, I was so busy with my career and life. I mean, all of a sudden, I mean, you know, that they said, you won a BAFTA. I won a BAFTA. And actually, believe it or not, I received a check in the mail for that.
What?
I don't think they get money anymore.
No, they don't.
I received a check. I don't really know how much it was. I should have framed it. But I received a check for winning the BAFTA. It's pretty amazing, huh?
They'll give you a little statue now and a goodie bag. That's what you
Oh, mean. Yeah. Right, right. That's it. That's all. I was just at the BAFTA, too, a couple of months ago. Yeah.
Oppenheimer?
For Oppenheimer, right. Uh-huh. We were nominated for a BAFTA, yes.
And an Oscar this year as well, wasn't it?
No. We were nominated for an Oscar, but we didn't win.
I just saw the most amazing thing of my entire life. First, you gotta do the truffle shuffle. Come on. Do it. Come on. Do it.
We can talk now.
Wow. What a character Cooper is. I mean, he's bugged your house, your garden. It's unbelievable.
Brown.
I'm sorry, sir, but Cooper's such a professional. He always has been.
I really thought we had him this time.
Hey, Ben, this is the plan.
Number five, come on out. It's
is
okay.
Is it cool?
It's okay. These guys aren't going to hurt you. They're your friends.
No disassemble?
No. They just want to talk to you.
I'm going to say it's simple. And I hope to God, for your sakes, you all listen.
There are no abominable snowmen. There are no Sasquatches. There are no Big Feet.
Oh, God, my jaw.
Oh, sometimes the truth is painful, Frank, but it's made your cheeks all rosy and your eyes bright as stars.
If you touch me again, I'm going to rip your goddamn wings off.
That's my youth right there.
Found the 80s, huh?
Like, you've worked on so much stuff that carries so much cultural weight, in my book anyway, and I'm sure in a lot of people's lives, you know? The Goonies, The Man with the One Red Shoe, Short Circuit, Harry and the Hendersons. Short Circuit.
The Goonies, that was an amazing project. I mean, it just, it was probably, out of the films you just mentioned, it probably was one of the most challenging films to do because you got the kids, you know, they, you know, and you say, don't overlap, but they just kids. And film it in Oregon. I mean, it's like we filmed in the rain. I mean, I remember it rained for a week straight, 7 days straight it rained, day, night, whatever. So now you got to get out there in the rain and do these dialogue scenes, you know? And the kids are running in the rain and the mud and through the fields. But somehow, you know, we made it work.
It's a classic movie that will live on forever.
Oh, yeah, people never forget that. I mean, people that grew up in that era, probably like you, you know, they say to me, you worked on The Goonies? Oh, my God, The Goonies. I mean, and that was my first introduction to Steven Spielberg. And that's after that, that's when I started working with Steven.
Richard Donner directed it, correct?
But Steven did a lot of second unit. Uh-huh. And some of it that Steven wanted to do some things himself, you know. And so... And then he said to me after that, he says, I'm going to do this film, The Color Purple. Would you be interested? I said, absolutely. And that's how, from that show to, you know, to The Color Purple.
One penny of my money, not one thin dime.
Did I ever ask you for anything? Did I ever ask you for anything? I never asked you for nothing, not even your sorry ass hand in marriage. Nothing. I never asked you for nothing.
Oh, Sophia home now. Sophia home. Things gonna be changing around here, too.
I'm going with Shug.
You going where?
I'm going with Miss Celia and Shug. Because I'm fixing to sing.
Too much racket going on around this house. Pass me them peas.
Yeah.
To be honest, I have to say thanks. Because in the house, we always had a copy of The Color Purple and I never watched it.
Right, like
I was watching The Goonies. I was watching War Games. Such a rich tapestry of a movie, isn't it? Like, I watched it a couple of months ago. Did you enjoy that process?
Oh, absolutely. Working with Steven, I mean, that was an experience, a good experience. I learned a lot. You know, it's funny that no matter how many projects you worked on, you always learn something.
Oh, yeah.
And with Steven, I mean, you know, we record the cornfields, running through the cornfields. And I remember on the weekend, we would drive on the weekends and just sound to get the frogs by the lake. We get them in the morning, we get them at night, we recorded all of that. And just incredible stuff and incredible experience and the performance in The Color Purple were just to die for, dynamite. Look at Oprah, started from The Color Purple.
Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah, it was really their first acting parts.
Yeah, that first, I mean, Whoopi, I think it was Oprah for sure. Yeah. Whoopi, I think so as well. The major acting parts anyway, that first role. And they were so good. They were so good. And Mark Avery, we keep in touch from time to time today. And she was just shook. I mean, they were just so good. And I remember the scene where Mr. was... Putting the girl, I forget her name now, not silly, but putting the girl out of the house, throwing rocks at her.
It was the sister, wasn't it?
The sister. I'm trying to think of her name. I can't remember her name. But Mr. was running his sister away from the house, and he was throwing rocks at her. And everybody was screaming. She was screaming and said, don't go, don't go. And she was running away, and he was yelling. And I look around and there's a tear in Steve and I, And half the crew was tearing up because that scene was so powerful.
Yeah.
An incredible, powerful scene. And I just thought, you know, we're really making a movie here. We have a real movie going.
It's an amazing feeling, isn't it? When you can feel the raw energy in the scene. It's just, it's magic.
Now you look around and you hear some sniffles. You know what? You hear some sniffles in the background. And I'm doing sound, right?
Yeah.
I'm doing sound. I hear these little sniffles. I'm looking around. The next thing I know, I'm tearing up. You know what I mean? And I'm the sound mixer. Yeah. But that's what happens with these. With a powerful emotion scene like that, that's what happens. I mean, that's just how it works.
It's like sometimes you hit record and you're trying not to ride the fader in like an emotional scene or something like that, but you're just sitting there with your jaw open.
Right. Oh, yes.
And you're just like, you know. And you know when you press stop, it's like, that's a bit of magic.
You know. When I read the script, you know, the Color Purple script, I thought, oh, this is incredible. And with Quincy Jones involved with the music and all of that, I just said, it's going to be incredible. And it was. It was, yeah. I'm very thankful and grateful for my career that I've done a lot of great film, worked on a lot of great films, and it's been wonderful.
I think as well, you know the way they say, oh, the 70s and 80s and maybe some of the 90s was like the golden age of film?
Right.
You cruised right through that whole period and just picked some of the best apples. That's the way
I did. I did. I cruised. And during that time, like the 70s and the 80s, you were able to pick films more so than now. You know, like I said, you know, picking now is slim. So you take what you can get now.
Not you, man.
Why not me?
If you want to play like Bird, you gotta shoot shit like Bird. Is that what you thought? Is that what they told you?
I don't remember.
No! No! It don't help, man. It don't help. Don't you know that?
I know now.
Directed by Clint Eastwood, Forest Whitaker.
Wow.
Well, how did you get on there? Like, they really, Forest Whitaker and the wife, I forget who played the wife. That the Bird story is kind of dark for a few different reasons, but they really kind of.
Yeah, it's a dark film, yes.
Yeah, they lived it, didn't they? Like, it was on screen.
They lived it. Oh, they lived it. Forest Whitaker was so into his role. He was so into Bird. I mean, it just incredible. I mean, most incredible. And the music was wow. I mean, you know?
How did the music change? Because again, I looked at Forest Whitaker doing the Bird stuff, and he's in the music when he's playing. It was a playback.
Well, some of it was playback, and he did a portion of it. Some was playback, and some in post production they stripped some of the tracks as well and used some of the music from Bird. I mean, you know, they used some of that old music. They stripped it down. They put, the horn and stuff, and they mixed it all together. It's incredible. Post-production did an incredible job with that, with the music and everything.
Incredible, because like the Buddy Holly story, it looks live. Like an awful lot of time with musicals or, you know, playback, you'll spot it or, you know, you don't mind. The mind doesn't connect. It doesn't really matter. You're involved in the story.
Right. Yeah. Some of it we did do live, but then we did a lot of playback as well. Yes.
Clint Eastwood, going from Steven Spielberg to Clint Eastwood. How did that feel?
Oh, that was different because I had never worked with a director who says, let's just rehearse one. And then you rehearse it. He said, cut print. I got it. You know, I mean, you know, for me or for the actors, I mean, you know, it's like, okay, this is a good rehearsal for me. And no, cut print. I've got it. I mean, Clint Eastwood did more print takes on take one, a lot of take. And then some of the rehearsal takes was print. And he says, no, I got it. I'm happy with it. Let's move on to the close-ups. And you have to learn right away that you have to be right on. You know what I mean? You can't miss because you're not going to get 2, 3, 4 takes. Maybe two. If there are some serious problems, you might get two. But otherwise, no 3-4 takes. And I working with Steven, I mean, you know, he's going to do 3-5 takes. And you get a, you know, if you miss one, you get an opportunity. With Clint, no, you don't get a chance. You don't get many second chances. So I had to learn that. And once I, you know, learned that, then, you know how to deal with it.
Is it before, you know, video monitors and stuff on set like
that?
Oh,
yeah, but Clint does not use video monitors.
So your boom up, everybody has to be...
You have to be right on. Even today, I think, I haven't worked with Clint in a while, but I think even today, he does not use video monitors, video playbacks. And Clint does not have chairs on the set. As a sound mixer, I could have a chair. Maybe script could have a stool. No chairs for producers, no chairs for anybody. You have to stand up. So if the producer come on the set, you have to stand up. There's no video village, none of that. And sometimes, you know, for me, I need to see an idea what's going on. I just have to watch the rehearsal. You watch the rehearsal, and then you have to, in your mind, you have to say, okay, this is how it's going to be. You have to remember that because I'm not going to see it while we're rolling.
It's going to keep you on your toes, but that sounds attractive to me, to be honest. Mm-hmm. As you say, if you fine-tune yourself to it,
right.
When you get a shape on it.
Yeah, you have to fine-tune yourself, and you have to know that you're not going to have a monitor, so you have to definitely pay attention to the rehearsals and knowing where they go, when they're there. And not only that, you have to know when they say the line. Do they say the line from this point to that point? Or that, you know, you have to know all of that. If you don't, you can miss cues.
Is the rumor about him doing short days real?
Oh, he always do short days. Always have.
That's attractive to me as well.
Yeah, his days are, you know, 8 hours or so, sometimes less. I worked with him where he worked on Saturday. Now, like, we were shooting 6 day weeks on some of his projects. And half a day on Saturday.
Yeah. When I first got here, the 12-hour day, I was like, you're joking. Because in Ireland, we do 10.
Oh, you did 10. Yeah, sure. Well, I find most of the time actors want more than one take. They want at least two or three.
Yeah.
But with Clint, I mean, you know, you don't really get, just because you want it, you don't get it. If he's happy with his first take, that's what he's going to go with.
Do you feel that drives the actors in some ways, or do they learn just as quick as you?
Well, they have to learn quick, because I remember there was times when Forrest Whitaker says, you know, I was just warming up. I mean, I could do it. If I do another take, I'll be better. And Clint will say, it was so good, I don't need another take. And he's right. It was good.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, you learn to adjust. You have to adjust very fast.
That decision, like, there has to be respect shown to that decision making as well as a director to go, yeah, it's good enough. Great. Let's move on.
Right. And Clint always trusts his operator. You know, if the operator says it's good, it's good. He doesn't need, I don't need to see it. You telling me it's good, it's good. And he's always, I think he still uses the same operator today.
It's a very important thing. Actually, right, through the years, have you mostly have the same team?
My first boom man was Marvin Lewis.
Marvin Lewis.
And we were together for probably 30 years or so.
That's a
career.
And
then he had to have double knee surgery. I brought in a boom guy by the name of Gary Theart. And he worked with me. And then Marvin came back, and Gary became the third sound utility. And Marvin came back for a while. But Marvin had to have the knee surgery all over again in one knee. Then he couldn't work with me anymore. Then Gary stayed with me. Gary Theart stayed with me. Unfortunately, he passed. And Marvin passed before Gary. Marvin passed quite a few years ago. So then my new boom people, Douglas Schamberger, then Adam Mahundro is another person, boom person that works with me as well. And Adam is out of Chicago and L.A. So usually one of those two guys will work with me when I get a show.
I'm sorry to hear that.
I know. Yeah, it doesn't look good for my record. But anyway, losing boom guys, you know, I mean, but... I miss them. I miss Marvin so much. And I miss Gary, too. But I really miss Marvin because we were together for so long. So
it's such a long time to be. You're in hot debate sometimes. Like, you get to know each other inside out. You're with those people more than your family. A lot of the time.
And plus, you know, Marvin was a good friend. He was a family friend. And
we
had so much fun on location. We just had a lot of fun and laughter together. And Yes, it was great. You know, it was great. But unfortunately that, you know, sometimes things happen and we just have to move on.
That's life. Yeah. Yeah. A good team, it's like a, it's like an athlete or a musician, right, or a pianist. You know, it's like, you don't have to think they're doing it, I'm doing this. Like, right, there's so much interaction, and when it's that tight.
Right, right.
The fear of not getting it again as well. Like, I worked with people, you're thinking for each other.
And
it's a big thing having to even make the decision to go, okay, I'm going to try this person out.
Right, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Douglas Schamburger is my number one boom guy. And if he's not available, if he's on another project, then I get Adam Mahindro. And they both are very good and very talented. So with either one of those, I don't have to worry. But if I have to bring in someone else, I get nervous. You know what I mean? That, because they don't know the way I work and they're trying to learn. We're trying to figure it out.
Exactly.
Makes it a little bit more difficult.
Do you still get nervous on a first day?
The first day, I'm not so nervous about my job, but I'm always thinking that his equipment is going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, if the strike went on for what, 7-8 months, well, 7 months, I guess, whatever, the writer strike, the actor strike overlapping.
Yeah.
You know, you put it away. And believe it or not, I received a call to do pickups on Beverly Hills Cop 4.
Right.
Now, the equipment worked fine when I put it away. And when I went on the set, set everything up, and the recorder wouldn't talk to the mixer. It's my very first day. I mean, my first day. I mean, it's a 2 weeks reshoot. But fortunately enough, you know.
Grab the bag.
I had a backup recorder. But even when I test all my equipment out, and the first day I'm thinking, okay, we test it out. We load it on the truck. Now we're on, especially if you ship into another state. If the equipment works for the first 2 or 3 hours or whatever, then I'm fine. I'm good. So
yeah, the first 2 or 3 hours. When you get to lunch, it's like, Graham, we're up and running. But it's always like that. I still nowadays, you know, there's the anticipation. It's exactly what you're talking about.
Anticipation. The word is anticipation. That's it. Yes. Dreamgirls was a film that I couldn't wait to go to work every day.
Really?
It's one of the few films in my career that, because I knew when we got to work, it was like going to a live performance.
That's one of the questions I had for you. Like these are huge divas. So even if they were doing a bit of playback, they're hardly giving those performances without belting it out. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
So you're going to be around that concert atmosphere all the time anyway.
Right. And the cast was so good, besides the dramatic part of it. And the music was just so incredible. The girls on stage dancing, singing their hearts out, giving it their all. I mean, I just had such a great time. We worked a lot of hours on that film. We had to go set up the stage and put all the systems together and also the comms, make sure that the lighting crew and different people have their contacts and they could hear. And where people needed speakers. We had to wire all of that. So we would set up and film at a location. And then that night, we have to take all this equipment down and take it to the next location and be set up and ready to go the next morning.
It sounds like you nearly needed like a rock tour setup where the stage went ahead of you. Like there was two setups and that went ahead to the next.
That wasn't in the budget. So it was on us. They paid overtime versus paying someone to go set it up because normally it would be set up. But we would change locations so often that, you know, it just made it almost impossible. And we could have had setups there. But the thing about it, it just costs a lot more money for equipment. So yeah. We just take our same equipment and go from set to set, setting it up the next day. And and I didn't mind. I mean, it was a lot of hours, but it was so much fun working on that film that I enjoyed every minute of it.
And you won an Oscar for it.
Yeah, I won an Oscar. Didn't know I was going to win that, but I won an Oscar. It was a great time in my career.
Hey, Jake, where's Brooks?
Andy. And I thought I heard you out here.
I've been reassigned to you.
I know, they told me. Ain't that a kick in the head? Well, I'll give you the dime tour. Come on.
I think Shawshank was like 93. Was it around 93? I'll tell you a little story.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're talking about picking films, having a choice. I was not totally committed, but I had received a call from another production company to do a film. It was a big budget film and hadn't committed yet. And we just left it at that. So I received a call from the Shawshank Redemption production office asking me, was I available? Would I be interested in working on their film? I said, well, I'm sort of not totally committed, but I had talked to some people about working on another film. So the production manager says, let me rush you a script over. And even though the other film was a bigger budget film, longer shooting schedule, everything, but I turned it down for the Shawshank Redemption. And it's the best decision that I've ever made probably in my career. One of the best decisions I've ever made in my career because the script was so good. I just said, I've got to do this film.
Yeah.
And I made that decision to work on The Shawshank Redemption versus doing another film. I had the best time working on it. And it was so, once again, I mean, the performance from all that, from that cast was like, wow. I mean, every day it was just like, it was such, you know, just such a great place to be in Mansfield, Ohio.
You know, you're dragged into the world of the prison for the whole movie. And then the resolve of the whole thing is just, it just makes you feel really good to be alive. Like it's a beautiful.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because we were filming in the closed down prison, the old prison, but then the new prison was right very close by, so we did have to contend with the bells ringing and horns going off, and we had to deal with that for sound on a daily basis, and we had to work around that. But right. You know, it worked out. It worked out. You know, in our favor. So. And people was very cooperative. They wanted us there, so they were able to, you know, they worked with us to make sure we could get decent sound, and which we were able to get great sound and all of that. So which was good, yeah.
I think as well, when you look at it, it's a film that you can watch time and time again and you can still draw the same emotion from it.
Oh, yeah, I've seen it like at least a half a dozen times and I still feel good about it when I see it.
It just warms the soul.
Right, right, right. And a gift, I mean... For me, at the end of the film, I mean, you know, there was the production company traveled to St. Croix, Virgin Islands, just to do the last part of it. There was only like one line of sound, one line of dialogue. So the powers to be was discussing whether to take sound or not. Mm-hmm. And because it's just one line, we don't really need sound. But the director says, yeah, I want my sound team there.
Fair play to him.
So, which was pretty incredible. So we flew to St. Croix. We had these little villas on the waterfront my wife was traveling with some friends in the island, a different island, and she met up with me, and we went to St. Croix. And first day, they didn't eat sound, and we just hung around and had a nice time. And the second day, they said, well, we'll probably need sound around midday, like 12 o'clock or so. So they call us and says, okay, we're ready for sound. We load up. We go to the set by the waterfront. And we get there. They said, that's a wrap. We never recorded one line of dialogue. And it was so nice. And so it's like a bonus for the crew, or gift, however you want to say it, is that we could stay the rest of the week on the company in our villas where we were. And I had the best time ever. Travel around. We hired a guy to travel us around St. Croix, around the islands. And I never worked 1 hour, just having fun.
That's magic. I was just about to say to you, I don't think there's a line there.
I know. They don't do that anymore today. One line? No. I mean, if it's one line or whatever, one word, it can be half a dozen lines. They'll just say, oh, we'll record it on a iPhone or something. They'll put it in later.
Exactly.
But exactly. It was what an experience, you know. I mean, it was nice that, you know, it was Frank Darabont, the director. It was nice that he wanted sound to be part of the final shooting schedule. So, yeah.
To have that treatment on that movie,
right.
Is exceptional.
Yeah.
On the day of my judgment, when I stand before God and he asks me, why did I kill one of his true miracles? What am I going to say? That it was my job. My job.
You tell God the Father it was a kindness you done. I know you're hurting in word. I can feel it on you. But you ought to quit on it now. I want it to be over and done with. I do. I'm tired, boss. Tired of being on the road, lonely as a sparrow in the rain. I'm tired of never having me a buddy to be with, to tell me where we's going to, coming from, or why. Mostly I'm tired of people being ugly to each other. I'm tired of all the pain I feel and hear in the world every day. There's too much of it. It's like pieces of glass in my head all the time. Can you understand?
Yes, John, I think I can.
The Green Mile.
The Green Mile. Oh, my God. Emotional feelings that work on a film like that. I mean, so emotion and so actors are so talented. And just the feel. And that was built on a stage.
I meant to ask you that. Was it an old jail or just was the
no,
whole
that was
built?
That was built on a stage at the Formosa Studios in Hollywood. So much feelings. I mean, you know, the performance and oh, my God, when he goes to the electric chair, they're taking him. I mean, it's just like you just want to cry and you just want to feel so sad. And, you know, for him, you know, because it's just one of those things, you know, it's about having that inside feel and that why him, you know, but that's part of life. And it was so, such a great film to be a part of. And Tom Hanks, oh my God, Tom Hanks and the entire cast was just incredible.
Did you see a huge difference in Tom Hanks from like the Man with One Red Shoe up to the Green Mile? Was that your second time? Was that the first time you worked with him after the Man with Red Shoe?
I think so. I'm trying to remember. Did I work with Tom again? I don't think so. I think that was it. Trying to think. I don't think so. So the difference was from a beginner to a few years later, how his career has enhanced so much. I mean, you know, and he became that great actor. Even though the Man with One Red Shoe, he was good, no question about it. It's just a different type of movie. And
this is, for sure,
The Green Mile is more about a movie with feelings and emotions and all of that. So, which is amazing.
Michael Clarke Duncan.
Oh, wow.
Who has he sadly passed since, hasn't he?
He passed. He passed a few, maybe, I don't know, trying to think, 3-4 years ago, something like that, maybe 5 years ago.
What a human being. Oh, yeah. What a voice as well.
Great person, great guy, just so good to work with, so cooperative, and just a great voice, too. Great voice. And
it's nice when you're on set and you have like a beautiful voice to listen to. You can kind of just close your eyes sometimes and let it happen. And the emotion carries an awful lot.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of emotion came out of his voice, that's for sure. So it made it so much easier for us to record him.
Was there any kind of difference, like the difference in his size, like the practicality of the physical size difference? Did that give you problems in any way?
No, not really. I mean, it's always a challenge when you make someone so huge and the other person short. But, you try to, sometimes I remember that on that film, we're playing... because they're holding Michael headroom, we're playing the other person underneath. You know, play one on top, another underneath. It's not the perfect way to do it, but at least you get quality sound on a boom without having a wire on the person, yeah.
You can chase your tail a bit trying to figure something out in a technical manner. It's just like, get practical and just...
Yeah, you have to do what works, yeah. Even though, it might be, the quality might be a hair off, but that's, post-production can take care of that.
Now, you asked how you can help. We want federal legislation granting Negroes the right to vote unencumbered. And we want federal protocol eliminating the decades-long dismissal and illegal denial of blacks seeking to vote. And we want robust enforcement of that protocol.
Well, that's fine, but... Most of the South is still not desegregating. Let's not start another battle when we haven't even won the first. And you know what the next battle should be? The eradication of poverty. I'm calling it the war on poverty. It's a matter of political priorities. Poverty is going to be my focus at home, and I want you to help me with this. We can make big changes in these things for... people of all colors, and I know that matters to you, doesn't it? This voting thing is just going to have to wait.
Selma.
Another great film. I mean, for me, it was not only a real experience to work on this film, but an education for me, because not that I don't know a lot about history. I think I know quite a bit, but I learned so much about that time period, about what was going on, and with the marches and all of that, what was happening, and how people was treated. It was such an education for me to work on that film, and a great experience, and working with Ava DuVernay. That was my first time working with Ava, and she understood what was going on and how to work with us and get in sound and everything. And so that was great as well. So we just had, we had a great time. And matter of fact, Ava and I are friends today. We started from that film and we're friends today. And
did you shoot the whole thing in Selma?
No, we shot it in Atlanta, Georgia. And we went to Selma for like the last couple of weeks. The bridge was in Selma, Alabama.
Like those moments where, you're shooting something and you know it's carrying weight, or that it's emotion. Like, was there emotion?
Oh, yeah.
Especially doing the bridge.
Oh, yeah, the bridge. There was so much emotion, because not only that, I mean, you hear the horses, the hoof of the horses. I mean, even though we did long shots, wide shots, long shots, and in sound, I mean, as they are coming over the bridge to the other side, crossing the bridge, you hear the horses, the sound, and you just say, oh, my God. I mean, and then as you hear the sound of it, and then after that, you see the horse, and then you see the people, and it's like, oh, my God, it's heavy. That's heavy stuff, but... it's what, you know, it's filmmaking. Filmmaking at its finest.
Yeah, I'd say it was, I'd say there was a few heavy days on set.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
With Oprah Winfrey, like, is it a thing where on some movies that you do, you're just walking into people going, oh, how's it going? I haven't seen you. Like, would you be friends with Oprah at this point?
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know, I mean, I don't hang out with Oprah. You know, people of that caliber, you know, they're not, we're not in the same league. But when I see Oprah, it's almost like going back to The Color Purple at the beginning of her career. That's the feeling that we have. So, Willie, how are you? How have you been? You know, same thing. I mean, you know, what are you up to? What have you been up to? It's all about that. And it makes you feel so good. And it just, and Oprah is such a wonderful person. She's a nice person and she's very gracious. And I only see Oprah every so often. But when I see her, it's just like, you know, you just light up. It's like, Oprah.
Yeah.
And Oprah says to me, Willie, we're still doing it. You know what I mean? All these years later, we're still at it. We're still doing it. So it makes you feel really good.
It's crazy to have that connection with someone like Oprah,
right?
And the two of you having that connection to the first time that, like, not the first time that you were out, but the first big thing that the two of you were on.
Right, absolutely. Absolutely. You never forget that. You never forget it. You know?
No, it's a special connection, for sure.
Remember this day. It's too soon to determine what the results of the bombing are. But I'll bet the Japanese didn't like it.
This year's winner of the CAS Awards.
Winner of the CAS Awards, yes.
Yeah, it's kind of like Selma. It's like a story that I wish didn't exist in human history.
Right.
But what a way to tell it, like... It's a beautiful piece, isn't it?
Well, I have to say Christopher Nolan is pretty amazing. I mean that as a writer, as a director, as a producer, it's amazing how he put things together. You have to go into the production office to read the script. They don't let the script out.
Oh, really?
No, they don't send it to your email. You can't have a script. You have to go in the production office and read it. I was in Atlanta, Georgia, working on another film, Captain America. And so I was going to be off for the holidays. So I call up the production office of Oppenheimer and say, can I come in and read the script? And of course, it said to me that, we're going to be off, closed down for the holidays too. So it's like, well, I don't really have much time to read this script. Do I have to fly back to LA and take a day off or a couple of days off in Atlanta? Well, it ended up that my film in Atlanta, Captain America, delayed an additional week after New Year's. So I was able to go into the office to read the script for Oppenheimer. The script is so thick, it's like a book. For hours, I was reading the script. Then I broke for lunch and came back and finished. On a Christopher Nolan film, you get enough prep time, quite a bit of prep time, because he wants you on scout. He wants you in weekly meetings. Every week he has a meeting for all department heads to make sure you have everything you need. If there's any problems, you need to let him know during the meetings that you have a problem and that how you're going to, and he wants to know how you're going to deal with it, what you need to deal with it. Whether it's sound-wise, whether it means, okay, you're spending time dealing with wardrobe. Wardrobe, you know, if you can change something that's going to make noise for sound, you know, then you want to try to change it. And also working with props, for example, during the hearing period, during the hearing, they had all these microphones. Well, I wanted to make sure that we could get as many practical working microphones as possible, because it gives you a different sound than the conventional newer microphones. So I wanted to do all of that, but I did not have time because I was on another film. So I thought, well, I'm not going to be able to do this film. So I said to the producer, Thomas Hayslip, that maybe Chris wants to hire somebody else. He wanted my boom man that works with me, Douglas Schamberger, but I thought maybe he wants to hire someone else to work with Doug, because I don't have time to prep and all of that. And then Thomas got back to me and said, no, Chris wants you on the film. So my prepping was by computers and phone, and not being able to scout, never scouted any of the location. That's one thing I like to do with Chris, because Chris is so thorough, and you want to make sure you have everything in order, that my prep is totally 100% plus. But anyway, so I wasn't able to prep. But I did leave my film 2 or 3 days early in Atlanta, Georgia, and I came to back to L.A. just to get ready for the film, the 2 or 3 days before we start filming. And it was quite an experience. I mean, just to be involved. I was so excited to be involved because I knew very little about, you know, invention of the atomic bomb and all of that. And I realized it's going to be an education for me. And so we started off in New Mexico, Santa Fe, up in Ghost Ranch. And the conditions for sound for a film like that, it's always challenging, because you have the wind, you have the wind comes up every so often, you know, and the dust storms come up. And then we had snow as well, and, you know, a little bit of rain, you get it all. But the thing with Chris, I mean, you know, reason I like to be so prepared, and I'm prepared on every movie, but with Chris, you have to be overly prepared, because Chris does not like wireless microphones.
Brilliant.
The boom has to be hardwired.
Not brilliant.
All the sound is pretty much boom.
And hardwired.
Hardwired. And we're digging trenches to hide the cable. We're running the cables all around the set to keep the cables from, you know, being seen visually. So, I mean, that's what you have to do. And you don't make an announcement like on most projects, you know, the AD is saying, are they wired? Are they all wired? Are they ready to go? Go to the tray, wire them up. You don't want to say that loud around Chris, because he does not want to know you're putting a wire on somebody, on some of the actors. He wants hard lines. And you know, we put wires on a little bit when we need to, you know, like tweak it up a little bit or bring more presence in. But it has to be, you have to favor the boom no matter what you do. You want to mix it in with the boom, the wire and the boom together where it sounds like the boom. So that's what I have to do. Chris is so aware of sound. He's aware of every department, the problems you have, what's going on. He knows. And so he works with you, and he wants original sound. He does not want to do ADR. And because of that, he works with us using the IMAX camera, which is very, very loud. He uses it on the wide shot. All the time we use it on the wide shot. But if it's a long dialogue scene, we go in for close up, we use the silent camera, the sound camera.
That's perfect.
Yeah, which we get the sound that we need. But now there's times that when there's short scenes, like, you know, half a dozen lines or less, he will use the IMAX camera. But what he does, as soon as he get a print, we will do wild sound of the same scene, just sound only, props, everything, just like we did it on camera. He walks through and do the same intensity, same emotion, same feel. You don't have the actor standing still doing wild lines. They do the effects, they do everything. And we record that. And he actually used it because the timing is so close. The minute we get say cut print, the actor's still in the groove, so they just do it again. But and he wants performance. It's, you can't just not perform. He wants performance in the whole thing. And that's how we get around using the IMAX camera. One thing from post-production, I mean they said hardly any looping, maybe just a few lines. They had to do ADR, but almost no ADR.
It sounds ideal, especially the fact that he works with you. Like if he's making you do all those things and then letting camera do everything that they want, fair enough. But then I suppose it's like what you're saying about Clint Eastwood. It's like you learn how to work that job. But because you're saying as well, because he has so much knowledge of all the departments,
right?
Then you're not going to panic. You're going to go, well, we're going to get it. Or, you know, you just reshuffle a little bit. Yeah. But I'd prefer to work like that than a lot of the jobs nowadays.
Yeah, right. And with Chris, you're going to get it. He wants you to get it. He wants good sound. He'll say, how was it, Willie? I mean, he will work with you. And he's not going to say, we don't have time. Let's just go. No, he wants it. He wants it good because he doesn't want to replace it later. So it's a great experience for me. It's almost like working in the old school way when we didn't use radio mics. You know what I mean? It's almost like working that way. And we get the sound that we need. But also, I do this in all movies. I'm sure most mixers do this. Pretty much all mixers should do this. I record a lot of wild tracks, wild effects, whatever's going on. Chris wants natural sound. The only way I won't record a effects track is that it's something I know we can't use. It's disturbing for the film. But if it's something that relates to the film, whatever it is, I mean, the windmill, whatever's turning, whatever's happening, we record it. The wind noise, I mean, you know, we record it all. So now he has a lot to work with. And in Oppenheimer, the stomping sequence, I mean, that's like incredible sequence. And I knew that, okay, I have to record, I have to use a few microphones to make this work. You know, we had mics all over the place, perspective wise, I mean, close up, medium, you know, wide, everywhere, you know, just to make sure that there was enough sound so the post-production can put this together, make it work and have nice sound. Yeah. They could blend it all together from the close-ups to the wide sound on the boom mics and stuff. And that's how we recorded that. And they used that, you know, enhanced it a little bit here and there, but that was all usable effects. And that's what makes this movie so incredible.
I've always, I came from music. So to my fault, sometimes I'm off mic and the subway or, you know, the cars or whatever.
Right.
But I've been told in the past, but loads of times by other mixers, oh no, stop doing that. They'll never use that. But I still do it. Like, I know that it makes sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, you want to give them more. It's best to have more than not enough.
Exactly.
And that way they can say yes or no. We like it, we don't. If you have too much, they just toss it aside. So, But it's a great experience working with Chris because he cares so much. And I care, you know, as a sound mixer, we all do. We all care about our product, about our end results. And I have to say that, you know, Oppenheimer was a great film put together and in post-production. And one thing I didn't realize what surprised me so much is that the music and sound was merged together to become it's a character. It's a character within itself. Working with Chris, I never know, like Oppenheimer, I never knew how this was going to be put together because it's two stories. You know, it's it's a hearing and it's a real story. So, it was magnificently a great job, I have to say. So, you know.
When it's talking about the bomb or when it's gone to physics,
right.
The composer was using modern techniques in like glitching things and making things, right, you know, very subby and stuff. But then when it came to the guys, it was more dramatic, like back to normal drama, back to the normal, strings would, yes, come in and stuff. And it's a beautiful, it's very well put together.
It was very well. I mean, it is the highest quality of filmmaking that you ever want to see. I mean, you know, it, yeah, it's the best. And I just for thought, sure, what an amazing piece that I was fortunate enough to be part of. And that movie would be, you know, once again, it'd be around forever. So, you know.
And you nearly turned it down.
Well, I only was going to turn it down, just to be fair to Chris and Kate, because, yeah, I know how Chris is as far as prep. He wants you to be there, and I couldn't be there. So I thought, well, yeah, give him an opportunity, hoping he would say, no, I want Willie. Well, he did say he wants me. So he wanted me. Yeah, he did say he wanted me. So and that made me feel good because I really wanted to do the film. Yeah, I've had the pleasure of working with some great people, and just it's all good. It's been all good. So, yeah.
Well, Willie, thanks very much. Thanks very much for all my childhood memories and recording them for me.
Patrick, thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Enjoy.
Take care.
All right, take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Say, Clyde, let me ask you a question. If you had a boxing match between Muhammad Ali and Sammy Davis Jr., how much do you think he'd draw?
Are you crazy?
No, I'm serious. How much?
And I suppose you'd want me to hypnotize Sammy.
No. You hear me? N-O. No.
Millions of people betting against Sammy Davis Jr. Ain't nobody gonna bet on Sammy Davis Jr. Man don't weigh but about 118 pounds. Fighting a man weighs 230 pounds. Ali be so comfortable, he'd come in weighing 340 pounds. Come in and hit Sammy dead on top of the head, break both his legs, that'd be the end of the fight. But if you hypnotize him, we go in there 800 to 1 hour. Take me up to
you don't want to compromise, just digging on the clothes you wear. I'm just a man now, don't you fear? I can love you now, don't you hear? I wanna do it again.
Looking for more audio-related podcasts to listen to? We're part of the Audio Podcast Alliance, featuring a hand-picked selection of the very best podcasts about sound. Be sure to hear the latest episodes from our friends in the community at audiopodcast.org.